Welcome back to The Roundtable. I'm Ian Pickus. Things have been going unprecedentedly well for comedian Marc Maron in recent years. His podcast, WTF, began as an upstart taped in his garage and is now chugging past its 500th episode, downloaded by millions. His eponymous TV show is now in its second season on IFC, and his book, Attempting Normal, is now out in paperback. But if you know anything about Maron and his more than quarter-century stand-up career, you know he's probably looking over his shoulder right this minute, wondering when everything will come to a crashing halt. Maron's self-doubt and self-loathing have made for fertile comedic ground on stage, in his one-man shows, and on screen. And it's my pleasure to welcome Marc Maron back to the roundtable. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure. I think that was a good intro. I am looking over my shoulder. I don't like it. It's not a choice.
You don't have a chance to really rest on your laurels, do you?
Well, I do, but I guess I choose not to for some reason. Maybe I'm superstitious. Maybe I don't know how to rest. I think that's probably more the issue, is that I don't really know what to do when I'm not doing anything other than think that something, I should be worried about something. So I just keep moving. But I do take some time to be grateful for the journey and for where I've ended up, because it didn't look like it was going to end up here, and I'm doing okay.
Take us back, because you've talked a lot about how when you went into that garage, it was either going to be the start of this podcast or, you know, you might kill yourself in there. With, of course, you're joking a little, I think, but now you've just gone past 500 episodes, and this has really turned things around.
That's definitely true. I think I was being a bit dramatic, but the depression that I was experiencing, you know, towards the beginning, you know, at the beginning of the podcast, I'd just gotten out of another turn on working for a radio company, and we did a streaming video show that didn't work out, and it was just sort of out of desperation. I just didn't have anything else going, and more deeply, I didn't know what else I would do. I don't know that I'm prepared mentally or emotionally to do anything than what I do, which is stand-up comedy or work in this, on these type of mics. There's plenty of things I'm capable of, but it just, as that was my dream, and that was what I'd spent my life moving towards, the idea of doing something, there was just no plan B. I mean, I imagine some people have experienced that. It's an awful feeling that you hit a wall in your life and you're at an age. I mean, I was 47 or something, 46 or 47. And in my mind, you know, I would say, like, well, you know, this isn't working out. I could always, and there's just nothing there. There's nothing in place there. They've all faded. So the fact that things turned around in that moment, it took a little time for them to do so, but I was passionate about what I was doing. But again, that doesn't always mean that things are going to work out. Things didn't necessarily have to work out. I just think for once in my life, I had some pretty good cosmic timing that couldn't have been calculated at all. When we started the podcast, there was really no expectation other than to keep moving, to keep working, to keep talking, to keep trying things. The only commitment we made was to do two new episodes a week, no matter what. And then we let the show evolve and things happened.
There's that hilarious moment in your book where you say, well, you know, I could always go back and work in the kitchen, and then realize that you hadn't been in a kitchen since like 1987 or something.
Well, yeah, I mean, that was really the last job. I think practically speaking, yeah, I could have found some way to work in show business, but I don't know that my pride would have allowed it. But the last job I really had that had nothing to do with show business, was I was a grill cook. I was a short order guy at a place in Brookline, Massachusetts. And yeah, you know, I don't think I could walk in and go like, yeah, I can still make pancakes or a sandwich. And they look at a 25-year hole on my resume. Well, what have you been doing during that time? Well, I don't know. I could show you my reel. You watch Conan?
Conan's been good to you. You've set the record, I think, for most stand-up appearances. You didn't do The Tonight Show when Conan did it for that brief period. How come?
Well, I mean, yeah, I think I'm up there. You know, I do panel mostly. I haven't done, like, straight stand-up there, you know, since 96 probably, but I like being a panel guest. I'm right up there with some of the people that have been on there most. Well, at first I took it personally, but then, you know, I realized, not unlike Jimmy Fallon now, they're making choices based on something other than a personal relationship. I don't think there was ever a question that I couldn't have, you know, done well. But I think they were trying to focus on, known celebrities and also, you know, younger comics that people maybe didn't know. I don't know. Maybe I'm rationalizing. But I know it wasn't personal between me and Conan. It was a show decision. And sometimes you just got to suck that stuff up in show business.
Hmm. Getting back to the podcast for a second, now you've talked to pretty much everyone who works in comedy. You've done a lot of, you know, rock music. And thanks for the Chris Cornell one, by the way. I'm a big Soundgarden fan. That was cool.
Oh, thanks.
I wondered, you've gone so deep in the personal side with many of your guests, but have you learned anything about, like, the craft of comedy from doing this show?
Well, I know that there are people that do it differently. I mean, the craft of comedy, you know, we all have different styles and we all have different needs up there. And, you know, some people are more disciplined than others. Some people improvise. Some people write jokes. Some people are very diligent they in terms of how they construct material. I mean, I don't know that I learned anything other than a lot of us have different styles and a lot of us have different disciplines. And a lot of us look at comedy as serving a different purpose. I mean, straight stand-ups, I mean, I understand them. We're all doing some variation of the same thing. It's just some people are more disciplined than others and some people write more than others. I learned that my style is relatively rare, and I don't know if it's the best way to do it, but it's the way I do it. But I like to evolve things on stage. So I think I have learned more so than about the craft of comedy, just about, you know, the struggles that all comedians have in it, no matter what level they're at, that perhaps those struggles persist.
Can you say a little bit more about what your style is and how you go about? I mean, how long are you working things out, maybe on a quiet shift at your local club or something? How often is it changing on the road and that kind of thing?
Well, I mean, I generally work long form. I generally don't prepare that well. I generally make an outline for myself of topics that I'm talking about and things I want to do. And they don't really sort of mold into something consistent for many months. I'm always looking for new beats and I'm looking to tighten things up. But in order to do it the way I do it, you know, I have to be on stage like at least two or three times a week. And like when I was working on my new hour, I would just get a sort of residency at a small theater once a week on a Tuesday. And I wouldn't really publicize it. And I'd just tell my fans that, look, I got to work stuff out. I don't know where it's going to go. So I'd go up there with an outline and I'd just ramble for an hour and a half and try to find something and record some stuff. And sometimes I listen to those recordings. Sometimes I don't. I really should. But this has always been the way it's gone for me. It's just an ongoing conversation and evolving conversation up there. And the stuff that sticks, sticks. And if I choose to work on beats within a long bit, yeah, then it takes a little more diligence, and that means on shorter sets, I have to figure out whether I want to do a 9-minute bit, you know, in the context of a 15-minute set. So when I go on the road, I always leave plenty of room to kind of improvise and also let things sit there a little bit. I think a lot of where I get some of my best laughs are when things don't quite go the way they're going, or I'm forced into the present in a very real way. I think that's a unique place to be on stage.
Yeah, that happened at your show in Albany a couple years ago, last year maybe. There was a guy on crutches or something, and you just went for it. I'll never forget you kind of miming rolling the dice on stage, but it worked out in a funny way. It wasn't like a permanent injury.
Yeah, well, you know, I don't know. I do kind of remember that. I do know it did work out, but I don't think I really thought it through initially, and then I was hoping that it wasn't something too tragic. But I like that kind of stuff. I mean, that's pretty straight up crowd work. But usually, you know, when I do that, I'm not at a loss, but I'm at a place where I need to connect, and I just really need to talk to somebody, to talk to the crowd, to see where we're at, to bring the experience into the present. I don't like it when I get detached or I'm just moving through material. I'm not really capable of doing it that well in terms of autopiloting. It seems that it's always been deeper than the laugh for me. So that seems to be the way I move through it.
One thing I've loved about your show is that you've been solving your SNL mystery for the last several years. And every time you have someone from that mid-90s era on the show, you get to kind of piece another thing together with Lauren Michaels. This is something you also write about in the book Attempting Normal. And I wonder if you've tried to book Lauren Michaels to be on WTF yet.
I have. I reached out. I called his office. I have to call back, I think. I don't think I'm really a priority for him. I don't know what I would get out of him. I mean, I'd enjoy interviewing him about his life and about his early, you know, beginnings in stand-up and whatnot. But I'd ultimately want some sort of closure. And I don't think it could go wrong any way it happens. Like, the worst that could happen is he just has no recollection of it, which would be fine. That might be the best thing, that I've been hung up on this thing that was just a small blip on, you know, this parade of people that he's been, you know, interviewing in his office for half a century or however long he's been, 76, 86, 96, 2000, you know, for 25, 30 years. Or, you know, he has some recollection and I can get some, a little more engagement out of him. Any way it happens, it would be great. I have reached out. I'd probably have to be a bit more persistent.
Let's talk about your parents a little bit. If people have been watching Maron on IFC, they know that you deal with your parents in real life and on the show. They're kind of offbeat characters. And you wrote something in the acknowledgments of your book that you thank them for eventually being okay with what you wrote about here. They don't always come off so well, as they don't on the show as well. And I wonder what that process is like when you do, you know, go to them and say, I'm going to talk about this. Is this okay? Or does that even happen?
Well, I do it with my mother, but I didn't do it with my father. My father was not okay and probably isn't okay, but we're okay. There was a struggle there. It was a difficult thing. You know, I talked to David Sedaris about it, and because he writes about his family a lot, but, you know, his fundamental rule is to be respectful. He has a line there, and I don't know that I was operating within that rule. I don't think I was operating out of spite, but I was sharing my experience and what I think were the reasons that sort of explain me. You know, the way I talked about my parents was to sort of amplify my own understanding of myself and the reader's understanding of it. But I think my father felt betrayed, and he felt that I'd caused him unnecessary problems. And perhaps that's true, but I still did not feel that I owed him an apology for that, or that contrition was the way to deal with it. I felt that by writing about my parents the way I did, I took a bit more ownership of who I am and myself. So it was dicey with my dad, and about the TV show as well, which I couldn't understand because Judd Hirsch plays him, and it's a very fictionalized version, and Judd is arguably a better father. But you know, I didn't say that to my dad, of course, but it did cause friction. It did cause problems. But we ultimately seem to be okay now. But it's a risk you take. It's like rolling the dice. It's like anything else. You can do things in your life that will permanently alter relationships. I think everybody knows that. Anyone who's been through any sort of issue with another person or a parent or marriage or child, whatever. I mean, there are things that happen. And it's if they happen intentionally, I guess you got to know going in that you're going to have to take responsibility for that one way or the other and live with it or regret it.
You know, you've just turned 50, and people who listen to your show know that you've been agonizing for a while over whether to have kids or not. You recently had a breakup, I think partially at least, over that very issue. You've had so many issues with your parents, but don't you think that if you had a kid now, you would be better for having waited this long in terms of what not to put on that kid?
Yeah, I definitely believe that. When I was thinking about having a child, it was with a woman who was significantly younger than me, and it was really not about the child issue itself. There were problems in that relationship that didn't make me feel, that made me uncomfortable with following through with that. And I do think I'd be a better father now. I do think that my primary liability is I'm a bit panicky and kind of a worrier, and I seem to look for things to worry about. And I imagine that all parents have that to some degree. My parents, that was what they did, as opposed to be loving or nurturing, is just panic and worry, and then, you know, worry about themselves as well. But I do think I would be good. I don't believe it's going to happen, because, like, at my age, for whatever reason, I just didn't think about children. In my two marriages, I don't think I was ready to have children. It wasn't a priority. It was not one of my goals. I'm not sure it is now, but I do believe that if I were to have one, the big issue is that obviously the woman would have to be significantly younger than me, and she'd really need to shoulder about, you know, 80% of the burden of that child and be willing to do that, you know, just by virtue of the fact that I'm going to be very old soon. You know, if I make it, when the kid's 15, I'll be 65. So there's a lot of factors. I just don't think it's going to happen. But yeah, I do think I would be a better father for waiting. But I also know that my brother, even though he wanted to do it differently than my parents with a vengeance, you know, whatever the subtext or whatever the you know, whatever is kind of flowing beneath the surface, beneath whatever you think you're doing different, if it's deep enough emotionally, it will manifest. So it's a tricky business.
you're such a kind of hot commodity right now in comedy. As I mentioned, your show's very well reviewed and people are watching it, and your podcast is popular as ever. Is there something that you are working on now, or something that you want to do that would not have been possible, a few years ago? And if so, what is it?
Well, I think everything is different, because I think that, through the podcast and through sort of, I don't know that making money was as important to me as being relevant somehow. And I think that because people get so much out of my podcast, and that it's completely my baby, and my business partner and I are very proud of it. It gave me a genuine sense of self-esteem and validation that I don't think I had. So it's helped my confidence in a lot of ways. I don't know that there's something I want to be doing that I couldn't have done, but certainly the possibilities are there, to hopefully direct. I directed an episode of Marin this season, and that seems interesting to me, and perhaps writing something longer, like a film. But like, I seem to be a little hung up with playing guitar and singing a bit. I'd like to do that, but that has no bearing. That, I could have done that any time, but I feel a craving to play with some guys. I don't think I want to tour or anything. I'm not thinking about putting a band together, but I would like to lay some tracks down. I recently was in Nashville, and I got invited to play on a track with a band and who were fans of mine. It was pretty exciting. I'd like to play some music, I think.
You have a guitar in your hands a lot of times on your TV show, and you've interviewed so many rock musicians and written about your love of music. So I wonder, you're such a hard worker. If you had spent, a couple decades on the road as a guitarist and not a comedian, do you think you could have hacked it as a pro musician?
No, because I never had the confidence, really, and I still don't. I mean, I can play something pretty well, and I can learn things, but I don't think I had the discipline. I mean, being on the road, I've been on the road, but not in that context. I don't know if I could be on the road in a band that was struggling. That seems brutal. And I never really set out to be a professional musician. I was always very insecure about it, about my playing, and I don't know that I was disciplined enough to necessarily get better. But over the years, I've seemed to have accepted my limitations and focused within them, and I'm pretty good at working within those limitations. So I just think it would be fun to play with some people.
Overall, are you happy?
I feel okay, man. I don't know if I'm happy, because my brain tends to look for things to fester about, but I feel comfortable. I'm just not always clear that when everything settles down, and like we said at the beginning, when there is some free time, I don't know what to do with myself. I have, there's been a lot of emotional wreckage in my past in terms of relationships and stuff, so I am here alone without really a clue as to how to move forward into, changing that in a healthy way. So that causes a little bit of sadness, but a lot of stuff is in place, and I do feel like things have leveled off. I'm happy to be, earning an honest living and having health insurance and making a difference in my life and other people's lives with the work I'm doing. But the emotional stuff is a little sad sometimes. But other than that, I'm good.
Good. Well, you can read all about the emotional stuff in Marc Maron, Attempting Normal. It's out now in paperback. Marc Maron is the host of the popular podcast WTF, and he stars in Maron on IFC. Marc, it's just been an honor to speak with you, and thank you, and thanks for the show, too. It's always fun to listen to. I appreciate your time.
Great talking to you, man.
And you're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.